GoDaddy.com. Use the code PODSAVE, that's PODSAVE 139, for $5 off of orders that are $30 or more. GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1145, August 27, 2009.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from, I guess, I'm near Lewiston, Maine. Spent the night last night there at kind of in a weird place alongside of a road there in Pennsylvania. I guess it was Rice Hill Township. And it turned out that nobody bothered me. I think, you know, I had my alarm set for about, I guess it was 11:30 Eastern time. I had my alarm set for 11:30 Eastern time, and it went off, and got up and quickly got underway and got headed on up here towards Maine. So, but nobody bothered me, and, you know, it was just, it turned out to be an okay place to park, and so it just, you know, it did work out. I almost, you know, I always find a place to park. Now this evening, you know, I was led to believe that this was probably going to be a drop and hook with this load coming to Lewiston, Maine. When I was here before, it's going to a Walmart warehouse. When I was here before, it was a drop and hook. I've been there at least twice, and it was a drop and hook. And when I initially got there this evening, the guard thought it would probably be a drop and hook, but he checked in the computer and it was an actual appointment, was how it was logged in there. And so he said, well, you'll have to come back tomorrow. And so, you know, I came about 5 miles south. There's a couple of kind of small truck stops. And so the bigger of the two small truck stops, every parking spot was taken. And so I came next door to this other little smaller place that just has a few little parking spots for trucks. And fortunately, I was able to find a place to park here. And, you know, so, but in any case, I'm spending the night right here. And then, so I'll time it so that I get back there at the appointment time's at noon, but Walmart wants you to actually show up about an hour ahead of time. So I'll show up there at that warehouse about 11 a.m. and then you know, they'll do the live unload, and then probably, I'm assuming after that, leaving Maine, typically it's almost always a load of paper back out of here. There probably are some exceptions to that, but that's typically what comes out of Maine is paper, loads of paper, either rolls of paper or, you know, just different types of loads of paper. And, you know, so that's probably what'll happen, but I don't really, know as of right now. You know, that I won't find that out until tomorrow. So, anyway, that the podcast I recorded last night, it was kind of, you know, it's kind of interesting. It was different. Of course, I recorded it with the Zoom H2 outside the truck, and it actually worked out pretty well because of the I was there, you know, kind of in a deserted, relatively deserted area, and was kind of able to since it remained fairly quiet, kind of capture the ambient noise with the Zoom H2, and so that worked out pretty well. So I should, you know, if I get the chance, I'll try to do more of that. Now I do a fair amount of recording with that Zoom H2. It periodically, what happens, I'll end up using it while I'm driving, making recordings while I'm driving, and but typically what ends up happening then, I'll maybe talk for several minutes and then I stop it and then I may, you know, start it again and so on and so forth, and I'll have maybe five or more, depending how long I talk each time, I may have five or more shorter recordings that have to be assembled into one longer one, and that can turn out to be more time consuming than making a longer recording on the computer. It's, of course, on the computer, you know, I like to do is, if I can, here with Ubercaster, kind of like a live one take type recording, but of course I've got the fine, you know, if I got a news article or some sort of an audio clip that I want to play or interact with, can't really do that with a portable recorder like I can with the computer, recording directly to the computer with a computer screen in front of me. So it's kind of a trade-off with time. But generally speaking, now, like the podcast I recorded last night, probably took, I'm going to guess, at least as much time or maybe even a little bit more time than it would have had I recorded it directly to the computer. But on the other hand, it, you know, it resulted in a little bit different type of sound, and you got to hear the freeway sounds and the bugs and what happened and what have you. So as I say, I'm going to try to do some more of those types of recordings, because I, you know, quite frankly, I like to listen to those. And, you know, a number of years ago, kind of Adam Curry did it, and then there was a period of time where everybody was making those sorts of recordings, sound scene tour type things, and those are interesting to listen to. There's no question about it. So I'm going to try to make more of those types of recordings when the opportunity presents itself. But as I say, I think probably the reason that most people have kind of gotten away from it is the fact that particularly if you're going to do a podcast like every day, it's just easier and faster to make the recording directly on a computer as opposed to, you know, recording on another device and then maybe having to boost the volume up to normalize it and then bring the file in and, you know, into your editor and render it and do all that, you know, do all the different things that may be necessary to do. So, on the other hand, I was like that one last night. That was pretty much all one take. Turned out to be about 45 minutes long. And you know, so I was able to do it probably in about the same amount of time as had I recorded it or recorded the podcast on the computer, like I am right now, all in one take. So anyway, I've got a couple of audio clips. One of them is a congressman. I think he's talking before Congress, and then there's another one that's a town hall meeting that's kind of a confrontational type of thing. And you know, I think what's happening in the country is pretty remarkable, with citizens beginning to kind of stand up. But I don't know, you know, it seems like, you know, our government is still trying, you know, there are certain elements in the government that are still trying to get their way. And what is happening, you know, on the one hand, is kind of heartening to see kind of citizens waking up and standing up. It was interesting. I was talking to course, you know, I talk to Ron Stroop quite a bit sometimes on the phone, and I've talked to him a couple of times in the past couple of days. He called me, and he's talking about his mom, and he said, you know, normally his mom has been kind of non-political and not really paying much attention to politics and what have you, and he was kind of surprised when he found out that not only has she been paying attention to this, all this healthcare stuff, but she actually called, the three people in Congress. You know, the senator, and then two congressmen, I guess. From her district there in Louisiana. You know, telling them she opposed healthcare, and he was kind of surprised, and actually I'm very surprised by that as well, because here you had someone that was just kind of non-political and acted very non-political, all of a sudden kind of coming to life, and not only coming to life, but kind of calling up her congressman and telling him, you know, hey, I'm against this. Now, I thought that was pretty remarkable, and I bet you that if she did it, then there's probably millions of other people that have been kind of non-political that are all of a sudden coming to life. And if that's the case, that's actually a very good thing. Now, on the other hand, there are some very negative things that continue to happen in the country as well. So, but let me go ahead. First of all, I'm going to play this. This was a town hall meeting, and so let's go ahead and listen to it. And as I say, this one is kind of confrontational. It goes on for about 2 minutes and 16 seconds.
Yes, sir. My name is David, and I'm from Camas, Washington.
Hi, David.
And but first of all, I want to let everybody know, since this is the thing tonight, that I'm a Marine Corps vet.
Thank you, David.
Like you, I did swear an oath to defend my Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Yeah.
Now, I heard you say tonight about educating our children, indoctrinating our children, whatever you want to call it.
Well, I didn't say indoctrinating.
So stay away from my kids. To let us keep our health insurance. Well, thank you. It's not your right to decide whether or not I keep my current plan or not. That's my decision. Now, I've heard recently in the media you and some other people on the national political stage call us brown shirts because we oppose it.
No, I did not. I've apologized for it.
Sir. Okay, well, thanks for apologizing, but I won't speak to you, then I'll speak to others. But I'll remind you, a little history lesson. The Nazis were the National Socialist Party. They were leftist. They took over the finance. They took over the car industry. They took over healthcare in that country. Nancy Pelosi wants to find a swastika, maybe the first place she should look is the sleeve of her own arm. Now, what I want to know is, you've done a lot of things that violate your constitutional oath, as you know. What I want to know is, as a Marine, as a disabled veteran that served this country, I have kept my oath. Do you ever intend to keep yours?
Yes, I do.
So that was actually a town hall meeting. Congressman Brian Baird. And that's just one of many. Now, this other audio clip that I have is Congressman Mike Rogers, and he's making an opening statement on health care reform in Washington, D.C. And so this is Congressman Mike Rogers.
Mr. Rogers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I
Can't tell you how much I'm disappointed at what a lost opportunity we have to, I think, solve a huge problem in healthcare and access and quality to some, even by your numbers, 46 million, and that's about 15% of the American population. Abraham Lincoln said, "You can't make a weak man strong by making a strong man weak." And so what we've decided to do today is abandon the very principles of America and say, you know what, it's so hard and it's so difficult, we're going to punish the 85% of Americans who have earned health care benefits as a part of their employment, and we're going to punish them and the employers who give it to them to try to cover the 15% that don't have it. That doesn't hardly seem like a solution that any of us would come to. Why would we punish the part that's working to cover the part that's not? It's like taking a queen-size sheet and trying to put it over a king-size bed. I will guarantee you the corners are going to come up. That's exactly what we've done here today. And this notion that it's either this or nothing is the chairman's choice. It's the Democrats' choice that it is either this or nothing. You present us very false choices. And let me tell you about the trade-offs by going to this government-run system. And oh, clearly it is, by the way, in Section 141 under the Health Choices Commissioner Act, they can actually go in and disenroll individuals. Unprecedented power by the federal government. They can rip you off your own individual plan. It's in the bill. Oh, matter of fact, if you're an employer, $250,000 of payroll. Payroll, that's gross payroll, not much. Guess what? They can disenroll your whole company off a certain plan. Tell me that you don't work for the federal government. Unbelievable. And here's the other trade-off. According to the National Cancer Institute, the National Cancer Intelligence Center for the United Kingdom, and the Canadian Cancer Registry, here's the trade-off that they picked by having government-run health care. If you get prostate cancer, you have a less chance of survivability than you do in the United States. And that's the same for skin cancer, breast cancer, bladder cancer, cervical cancer, kidney cancer, ovarian cancer, is leukemia, and the list goes on and on and on. So what you have said to America is, we give up. It's just too hard. The government has to do it. That's insulting. So what you're going to do is you're going to look your mothers and your daughters in the eye and say, I'm sorry, we couldn't figure it out. We wouldn't allow innovation to do it. We're not going to allow the private sector to fix this problem for us. That's too hard. But I am going to tell you that if you get breast cancer, I'm sorry, honey, you have less of a chance of survivable than you did before this bill passed. I will not punish any woman in America to this kind of system, knowing how great America is. The very innovation of who we are is what got us here. And it wasn't the federal government, and it wasn't Washington, D.C. It was individuals who stood up for themselves and said, we can do better. And because of that, we have the greatest middle class in the face of the earth. And this is one more tick in their ability to succeed in America. We've already told them that, gee, your energy prices were too high, middle class. We're going to raise those with cap and trade. Oh, by the way, we're going to tell you what kind of car to drive. We're going to tell you what kind of light bulb you can put in. Oh, I'm going to tell you what kind of window you have to replace your house with. And, oh, by the way, now I'm going to pick your doctor and your plan for your future. We must and can do better. This is a travesty, Mr. Chairman, and I yield back my time.
By the way, the gentleman's time.
Okay, so there was that was Congressman Mike Rogers, and he was making his statement in front of Congress. And so he's right. He's right on the money. Responsibility, you know, is tied directly to freedom. You know, the two are really sort of inseparable. And if you try to separate the two, you know, all you end up with is slavery and license. You know, there's a difference between being free to do, you know, to do whatever, and license, you know, kind of license to, you know, just basically, you know, and I'm using the term license sort of in the sense of, you know, people are free to be as immoral as they want. You know, they just have license to do whatever. But if you, if real freedom implies responsibility, and you know, if you have responsibility, then that's tied to freedom. But responsibility is not the same thing as being enslaved, because if you're simply enslaved and somebody's, you know, somebody's got a whip to your back and they're telling you, hey, you have to do this, that's not the same thing as having a responsibility, because a responsibility sort of implies you know you're volunteering to take a response, to do a responsibility. Usually you're not enslaved to the responsibility, so. But if you come along and the government kind of comes along and somebody tempts you and they say, hey, you can have this, you don't have to be responsible, we'll just give you this, and you don't have to be responsible for it, then that just spoils people. And before long, that's a proven recipe for enslavement. Because if you let's say you have kids, and of course I don't have any, never will have any, but let's say you have kids and you start giving your kid this and giving them that and don't teach them how to be responsible and the value of work and what have you. You just give them whatever, then they become lazy, they're robbed of their own initiative, they hate you for it, they may not realize why, they kind of realize somehow that they've been robbed of something, but they probably can't articulate it, they hate your guts, and they begin to demand, they expect you to continue to just keep doling the stuff out to them. As they become worse and worse, and you've made them slaves. You've enslaved them. At the same time, you've robbed them of their own initiative. You've enslaved them to you. And it's a sick kind of relationship. You see what happens in families that do that. Typically, families that spoil their kids. There's millions of American homes where that's happened. The family spoils the kids, and the kids just sit around and play video games and watch television, and the parents are kind of giving them everything, and typically those families, they've got credit out the yin yang, and sooner or later, they're kind of always riding on the verge of complete bankruptcy. And, it's ridiculous. So, but that's what the federal government, it kind of scales up to that. Because anything that happens, it's useful to remember that anything that can happen in the federal government happens in the average dysfunctional family. It's the exact same dynamics. Anything that can happen in a dysfunctional family scales up to the government size, and of course it may take a little bit different form, but the dynamics are exactly the same. I've got a few little news articles here that I thought were kind of interesting. This first one is from the dailymail.co.uk, and this homeless man bursts into flames after being tasered by U.S. police. A homeless man caught fire after U.S. police shocked him with a taser gun, it has been revealed. Daniel Wood, 31, was allegedly sniffing gas from an aerosol can as he ran through traffic when he was chased by two officers in Lancaster, Ohio. One officer caught Wood and got him on the ground, where Wood continued to resist, according to the police report. Another officer shouted a warning, then zapped Wood with the taser, the report said. Wood immediately burst into flames that covered his torso. The officers were forced to drop their weapons and beat out the flames. Wood said, my complete right half of my upper body is burned. I have bandages from my wrist all the way up to my arm across my chest. He admitted he had been inhaling vapors from a chemical cleaner. In an attempt to get high, Wood had been resisting arrest by attempting to bite the officers and lashing out with his feet. And, you know, and of course, you know, I was reading through some of the comments here, and some of these people were saying, you know, that this guy had been arrested more than 50 times. And, you know, and it's obvious this is someone that you would normally, you know, maybe 40 or 50 years ago, someone like this would have been in an institution. They would have been in a, you know, like a state-run mental institution. And, of course, we deinstitutionalized these people and today, and these people are just out and about in society, and they're responsible for all kinds of crimes. There are some people that cannot take care of themselves, and yet, oh, we can't, yo, you can't keep those people locked up against their will unless we got to mainstream them, push them out in society. And then, but of course, I think that's part of the madness that has overtaken our society, because, you know, we take people like that that can't take care of themselves, put them out on the street, and then, you know, then we can come along after the fact and say, well, look at these people. We can't give the general public guns. Look at what they do. Look at the general public. Look what happens. You know, and but it was, if you look, a lot of these shootings, school shootings, mall shootings, periodically you'll have these shootings that happen. A lot of these people would have been in a mental institution a number of years ago, and yet we're throwing them out on the street. And a lot of them, the other thing that they never mention is a lot of these people have been on various sorts of so-called psychotropic drugs to try to, you know, serotonin uptake inhibitors, what have you, try to get rid of their depression or to get rid of their psychotic behavior or control or schizophrenia or whatever. And, you know, rather, and of course, what ends up happening, they never, you know, if they do take the drugs, then, you know, you take a drug like that, you can continue to get worse. It may mask the symptoms, but most of the time these people go off the drugs because the drugs kind of drug them into a lethargic stupor, and they inevitably they end up going off the drugs, and then they go right back to the behavior that got them in trouble in the first place. And there are a lot of these people that deliberately commit crime so they can go back into jail, so that, you know, so that they have the jail structure to rely on. And you know, so it's a continuing problem. But we, you know, there are people that cannot take care of themselves. They just, you know, there are people that are that way. You know, and they've got a picture. I wish you could see the picture of this guy on this in this article. His eyes, you look him, you know, he's got his eyes open really wide in this picture, and he looks crazy. You know, he's just got his eyes kind of look, he's got the crazy look. And so, you know, this is just an example of someone that would be institutionalized if it was 30 or 40 years ago. Let's see here. So, anyway, as budget deficit grows, so do doubts on the dollar. And this is basically talking about, you know, they don't like, you know, the way the dollar's going. And I think we're headed probably for hyperinflation. I think that's probably around the corner here. You know, don't know how long, but, you know, they've been printing a lot of money, making a lot of money available, and it's asking for it. Democrats plan hundreds of reform rallies. Let's see here. Whoops. Where did we go? Come here. Firefox, you know, I use Firefox on this MacBook, And if you, I've noticed if you open up a bunch of Firefox, if you open up a bunch of tabs, it'll get to where it's just really sluggish. And I don't know if they've made Google Chrome available for OS 10 yet or not. But I know they were talking about it. But if they have, it's something I need to check to test out, because you know, I think Google Chrome generally on Windows that I've seen, because I have used it on Windows, it does have a much smaller memory footprint, and this Firefox seems to, over time, it seems to be getting more and more bloated. So anyway, Democrats plan hundreds of reform rallies. Faced with the souring public mood on health care reform, Democrats and their supporters are launching a national grassroots push Wednesday to show lawmakers that the majority of Americans still support overhauling the system. No, they don't. Reform supporters are planning to hold more than 500 events between Wednesday and when lawmakers return to Washington September 8, ranging from neighborhood-organized phone banks to professionally staffed rallies with hundreds of people. It's just fake. Ain't true. You know, they can have their, that's called astroturfing. This is a healthcare story, or a story. This is from the dailymail.co.uk. The babies born in hospital corridors, bed shortages forces 4,000 mothers to give birth in lifts, which is the, that's the, what the British call elevators, offices, and hospital toilets. Thousands of women are having to give birth outside maternity wards because of a lack of midwives and hospital beds. The lives of mothers and babies are being put at risk as births in locations ranging from toilets to lifts, even a caravan, which is a truck, went up 15% last year to almost 4,000. Health chiefs admit a lack of maternity beds is partly to blame for the crisis, with hundreds of women in labor being turned away from hospitals because they are full. Latest figures show that over the past 2 years, there were at least 63 births in ambulances and 608 in transit to hospitals, 117 births in A&E departments. I don't know what an A&E department is. 4 in minor injury units and 2 in medical assessment areas. 115 births on other hospital wards and 36 in other unspecified areas, including corridors. 399 in parts of maternity units other than labor beds, including postnatal and antenatal wards and reception areas. Additionally, overstretched maternity units shut their doors to any more women in labor on 553 occasions last year. Babies were born in offices, lifts, toilets, and a caravan, according to the Freedom of Information data for 2007 to 2008, from 117 out of 147 trusts which provide maternity services. One woman gave birth in a lift while being transferred to a labor ward from A&E, while another gave birth in a corridor, said East Cheshire NHS Trust. NHS is the National Health Service in Great Britain. Others said women had to give birth on the wards rather than in their own maternity room because the delivery suites were full. Tory health spokesman Andrew Lansley, who obtained the figures, said Labour had cut maternity beds by 2,340, or 22% since 1997. At the same time, birth rates had been rising sharply, up 20% in some areas. Mr. Lansley said new mothers should not be being put through the trauma of having to give birth in such inappropriate places. But that's, I don't know, this article goes on. And it's talking more about the maternity stuff. Let's see what else it says. Okay, and then it's talking about a case study. I gave birth in a car. Pregnant Linda Corbett, 33, was turned away from one hospital and gave birth in a car as she dashed to another. Her husband, Chris, 39, delivered their daughter, Iona, in the back seat while her father raced to the hospital at 70 miles per hour. I was really scared, but I had to hold it together as I was the only one who knew the way to the hospital, she said. The baby was born just as we entered the car park. Mrs. Corbett, pictured, was due to give birth at her Brighton home in June last year, but when she phoned the Royal Sussex County Hospital after her contraction started, she was told the maternity unit was too busy to send a midwife to her. When she phoned back later, she was told the unit was full and she would have to go to another hospital. 15 minutes later, she gave birth. She said, "We had such a happy ending, but it could have been a disaster." And so that's typical. That, you know, it's a bureaucrat. They're, "Oh, we're going to cut the maternity beds. Got to cut costs. Going to cut the maternity beds." Well, people, what are you going to do with the, you know, these women still have to give birth. So then the next thing they'll say is, "Well, we'll, you know, we'll just, you know, limit the number of pregnancies." That's where it's headed. I don't know if they, you know, they don't realize that yet, but that's exactly where it's headed. They'll cut, you know, in Britain particularly, they really seem headed racing towards a police state. That's exactly what's going to happen. They'll come along and say, we're going to regulate the number of births. You can't be, if you're pregnant, or you have, you don't, you know, we've already met the quota of new babies. You got to abort it. That's where it's headed. So, hope they, I don't know, hope they like to, you know, where, if, you know, where it's headed. You know, they, there was this article I read a few days ago, you know, where they were actually talking about putting the cameras in people's homes so that the government could monitor the, you know, monitor and make sure the kids are eating right and make sure that they go to bed in time and make sure they go to school. You know, and so on and so forth. You know, that's right out of 1984. It's insane. But that's where we're headed, too. That's where the United States is headed. That's where what we're headed for. Unless people wake up and put a stop to it. Here's another story from the dailymail.co.uk. Man collapses with ruptured appendix 3 weeks after NHS doctor, quote-unquote, took it out. After weeks of excruciating pain, Mark Watson was understandably relieved to have his appendix taken out. Doctors told him the operation was a success and he was sent home, but only a month later, the 35-year-old collapsed in agony and had to be taken back to Great Western Hospital in Swindon by ambulance. To his shock, surgeons from the same team told him that not only was his appendix still inside him, but it had ruptured, a potentially fatal complication. In a second operation, it was finally removed, leaving Mr. Watson fearing another organ might have been taken out during the first procedure. The blunder has left Mr. Watson jobless. Bosses at the shop where he worked did not believe the story and sacked him. Mr. Watson told of the moment he realized there had been a serious mistake. "I was lying on a stretcher in terrible pain, and a doctor came up to me and said that my appendix had burst," he said. "I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I told these people I had my appendix out just 4 weeks earlier, but it was on the scanner screen for all to see. I thought, what the hell did they slice me open for in the first place? I feel that if the surgery had been done correctly in the first place, I wouldn't be in the mess I am today. I'm disgusted by the whole experience." Mr. Watson first went under the knife on July 7 after experiencing severe abdominal pain for several weeks. He was discharged, but exactly a month later, he had to dial 999 after collapsing in agony. Following the second operation, his incision became infected, and he was admitted to hospital for a third time for treatment. He said, "I had a temporary job at a sports shop, but when I took in two medical certificates saying I had my appendix out twice, they didn't believe me. Now I'm helpless. I can't go out and find a job. I can't go to interviews. I can barely walk, and I'm in constant pain. Before the first operation, they told me I had to have my appendix removed, and when I woke up afterwards, they said it had been a complete success. But then I kneeled over in agony 1 month later, and when they did some tests at the hospital, we could see that the appendix was still there on the scans. As far as I was aware, they took my appendix out, and no one told me any different. I have no idea what they did take out, but I want to find out what went wrong." A spokesman for Great Western Hospital confirmed that a representative had met Mr. Watson and that an investigation had been started. He was unable to confirm what, if anything, was removed in the first operation. Paul Gearing, Deputy General Manager for General Surgery at Great Western Hospital, NHS Trust, said, "We are unable to comment on individual cases. However, we would like to apologize if Mr. Watson felt dissatisfied with the care he received at Great Western Hospital." Now, listen to that. That's typical bureaucratic gobbledygook. "However, we would like to apologize if Mr. Watson felt dissatisfied." If he felt dissatisfied. What in the hell if he felt dissatisfied at the care that he received at Great Western Hospital? That's insane. That's Orwellian doublespeak. Good grief. And that's what we're headed for. That's your precious, wonderful government health care. That's where it goes. Absolute insanity. Okay, we're waiting for Firefox to... Okay, let's see. Scientists design plant filtration system that lets you drink your own shower water. Boy, that sounds fun. Let's see here. See, South Korea launches first rocket into space. FTC to assess business of news. Federal Trade Commission. Just about everyone from the general public to news executives has an opinion about the future of journalism. Now, the Federal Trade Commission is stepping into the debate. The commission is planning 2 days of workshops in December titled "From Town Criers to Bloggers: How Will Journalism Survive the Internet Age?" To examine the state of the news industry. More often, the FTC tends to organize workshops related to consumer protection issues like mortgage fraud. But John Leibowitz, the FTC chairman, says the agency has taken a look at other industries through workshops on hospital competition, food marketing, and other patent system, and on the patent system. Journalism's future falls in the agency's purview, he said. Competition among news organizations involves more than just price, Mr. Leibowitz said in an interview. Disclosure, Mr. Leibowitz is married to Ruth Marcus, an editorial writer at the Washington Post, but he said the commissioners, who are a mix of Democrats and Republicans, are supportive of the workshops. Though some may be uncomfortable with the government oversight of any aspect of journalism, the FTC seems to be attempting to play a facilitating and public educational role in gathering together various disciplines and perspectives to talk about the crisis in mainstream journalism, said Neil Henry, a professor and dean at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. The government's willingness to raise the profile of this issue and to help explain why it is important for a national conversation, I think, is in general, is welcome. That being said, the industry may still have to fend for itself for solutions to its major problems. That, in the end, will be the work of journalists, business thinkers, entrepreneurs, engineers, technologists, and the people ourselves, Mr. Henry said. A report will be issued after the workshops that may make recommendations to lawmakers on changes in policies on anything ranging from taxation of news organizations to copyright issues. Mr. Leibowitz said he had no specific issues that had been chosen. We really want to keep an open mind, Mr. Leibowitz said. The workshops will help because we don't have any sense empirically of the nature of the problem, he said. So, well, a lot of it has to do with the fact that they're not objective. Most newspapers tend to, present kind of far leftist views, and they look down on, for the most part, they seem, most newspapers, especially big city newspapers, do kind of come across as tending to look down on their customers, that they know better than their customers, and by golly, the customers are just too stupid to appreciate what they're trying to brainwash them with, and people are just kind of getting tired of it. There's a lot of other alternatives, and newspapers, the circulations continue to drop, and even television, network television, their numbers are continuing to plummet. Not only the network TV news, but TV shows in general, that they're plummeting too. And I don't know, I think overall the movie business may be suffering as well, but there's just a lot of other choices, so it's becoming more of a much broader playing field as far as entertainment and information because of the internet primarily, and people have a lot more choices today than they've ever had in the past, and so some of those if you can't compete, it was easier to compete in the days when your million dollar printing press, $1 million transmission tower, $1 million studio kind of helped guarantee that you were going to be successful. But those days are gone because now everyone's kind of competing on a much more even basis, and you just end up with these gargantuan structures that worked in more monopolistic times no longer really function in the age of the internet. They don't function nearly as well, and so things have to change. Anyway, let's see, got this other article. Senator warns of hyperinflation rivaling the 1980s. Well, now, I don't know if we had hyperinflation in the 1980s. Anyway, the economy could spiral into hyperinflation, not seen since the early 1980s, if the Federal Reserve does not tighten its monetary policy soon, said Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican Iowa, warned Tuesday. Grassley, speaking about the renomination of Federal Reserve Chairman Senator Ben Bernanke, to a second term as head of the Fed, asserted that Bernanke's ability to hold down inflation would be the metric by which the Fed's success would be measured. We won't know for a year if he's done a good job so far because he shoveled money out of an airplane to save banks and the finance system, Grassley said in a conference with Iowa reporters. But shoveling money out of an airplane to solve problems can be inflationary, in this case hyperinflationary, if he doesn't start mopping up some of the money that's out there. Grassley, the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee, said that inflation as a result from government spending on bailouts could result in inflation rivaling rates in 1980 when it hit a peak of 13.5%. The Fed has the ability to put money out. It's got the ability to take money back in, and if they don't do that, we'll have another hyperinflation worse than we had in 1980 and 81, Grassley said. And I hope he demonstrates that ability. So Grassley argued that while it would be a year until lawmakers will know whether Bernanke has been successful at bringing inflation under control, it would probably be best to keep the chairman on board for a second term as head of the Federal Reserve. I would suggest that right now, when everybody's nervous about the economy, that you don't change horses in the middle of the stream, and consequently, it would probably be detrimental to not have him reappointed, he said. So,
thank you.
Yeah, excuse me. I was, you know, the last couple of paragraphs, I was feeling a sneeze coming on, and just waiting for it to happen. Let's see here, what else I had. Let's see, Russia deploys air defense on North Korea missile test. Real U.S. unemployment rate at 16%, and this is from a Fed, a Fed official, it says. The U.S. unemployment rate is 16% if persons who have dropped out of the labor pool and those working less than they would like are counted, at a Federal Reserve official said Wednesday. If one considers the people who would like a job and have stopped looking, so-called discouraged workers, and those who are working fewer hours than they want, the unemployment rate would move from the official 9.4% to 16%, said Atlanta Fed Chief Dennis Lockhart. He underscored that he was expressing his own views, which do not necessarily reflect those of my colleagues on the Federal Open Market Committee, the policy-setting body of the central bank. And it kind of goes on. So, but that's, I think, you know, they that's probably true. It probably is about 16%. I think that's accurate. Federal stimulus money sent to 4,000 cons. And this is from thebostonherald.com. One day after the Herald reported some surprised Bay State inmates, including murderers and rapists, were cashing in $250 stimulus checks, federal officials revealed the same behind-bars bonus was mailed to nearly 4,000 cons nationwide. A federal watchdog is now probing how the cons were cut the checks. The same cash also may have been sent to fugitive felons, people kicked out of the country, and even individuals now deceased. It's all part of the massive American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, and what is becoming an accounting nightmare for red-faced feds. It's just Chicago politics. It's just scaled up to the nationwide service. That's simple. You know, and it also demonstrates what is wrong. You know, government can't, you know, the bigger the government is, the more screwed up it becomes. And why people can't understand that, I don't know. But some people, it seems, you know, maybe half of the people in this country can't seem to get it through their thick heads that government can't do anything right. It really can't. You know, face the fact. I don't want to hear all this emotional gobbledygook. Face the fact. It doesn't work. We got to come up with better solutions and just get rid of the stupid emotional attachment to the idea that large government is going to fix things, because it can't. It's demonstrated over and over and over again that it can't. Got a news here from Bloomberg.com. Ellie McPherson can't counter London gloom as Americans flee. Andrew Weisbercher moved to London from New York in 2006 to sell software to banks and hedge funds. This month, he joined the exodus of American expatriates fleeing the high taxes and the city's shrinking financial industry. "I'm the last guy to leave that I know," said Westbecker, 29, who worked for Tibco Software Incorporated and lived in Notting Hill, the London neighborhood that's become home to billionaire Richard Branson and model Ellie McPherson. "We are all packing up. The U.S. Or the number of U.S. citizens in Britain fell 3.8% to 126,000 in the 12 months through September. According to the Office for National Statistics, the trend probably continued this year, with the Confederation of British Industry estimating that the UK financial industry will lose about 45,000 jobs in the first 9 months of 2009, or 4.3% of the total. Americans are heading home as Britain plans a 50% tax rate for those who earn more than £150,000, that's $248,000 a year, and employers cut benefits for workers living abroad, reducing the allure of London. That comes a year after the UK said foreigners who have lived in the country for more than 7 years must pay £30,000 annually or give up the special status that shields overseas income from British taxes. Expats feel the tone has changed, it's less welcoming, said Mark Tilden, a consultant at CRA International Incorporated, who wrote a report for the City of London last year on the impact of taxation on corporate relocation decisions. London's ability to attract talent has gone down. We are fed up. The worst recession since World War II has left the UK residents facing tax increases and spending cuts after Britain's monthly budget deficit ballooned to a record £8 billion in July. In addition, some employers are reducing benefits such as tax equalization, school tuition for children, and cost of living allowances that supplement expatriate salaries. Schools catering to international students report a drop in enrollment for the first time in 7 years, and relocation companies say they are moving fewer people to Britain. Janet Sherbo lives in London's Chelsea district with her husband, Nikos, I'm not going to try to pronounce the last name, the former chief executive officer at the European arm of Cambridge, Massachusetts-based management consulting firm Monitor Company. The family plans to move to Greece after the daughter finishes high school next year. We're fed up with the stealth taxes, the non-DOMS levy, and now the 50% tax rate, Sherbo said. Six American families have moved from my street in the last 6 months. Quality of life. 41% of employers plan to review expatriate programs, according to study by KPMG International. KPMG surveyed about 100 companies, 60% based in the U.S., and found that 22% had recalled overseas workers or turned them into local employees in the past 12 months. Huddling under an umbrella during a July downpour, Westbacher said he was no longer willing to put up with the frustrations of life in London after his commissions dropped from the Palo Alto, California-based TIBCO eliminated his expatriate benefits, cutting his take-home pay by 75%. This is what passes for summer in London, he said, sipping an iced latte in the city's main financial district. The quality of life is a lot harder. Things are more expensive and the houses are smaller. Even public transport is cramped. A New York subway car is like real estate in comparison. The economic picture is also gloomier in Britain. The UK economy shrank 5.6% in the year through June, compared with 3.9% in the US. London's financial industry lost 29,371 jobs, or 8.3% of the total, last year. According to the Center for Economic and Business Research, financial companies in New York cut 20,200 jobs, or 4.3%, data from the State Labor Department show. Highly competitive. The UK remains a highly competitive center for finance and investment and has excellent infrastructure for business, the Treasury said in an emailed response to questions. The American School in England, based outside London in Thorpe, Surrey, expects enrollments to fall 4% this year, the first drop since September 11 terror attacks. said Karen House, interim admissions director. The school charges about £29,000 for boarders, and 70% of its 750 students are American. ACS International Schools, which has 2,500 students on three campuses in the London area, will see a small decline in student numbers, and marketing manager Mark London, fees for boarding students run about £33,000 a year. Overall, this year we won't be at capacity, London said. The majority of our families are expat families who are working in London or the UK on an assignment. Undoubtedly, major companies will be cutting back on those. Anything to make money. Transfers to Britain from the U.S. fell 25% in the past year, according to Primacy Relocation LLC, a Memphis, Tennessee-based company that moves more than 50,000 people a year for corporate clients around the world. Repatriations were almost unchanged, suggesting the net American population is declining, said CEO Matt Spinello. There are signs of recovery, said Sharon Golden, a co-founder of Basingstoke, England-based Phoenix ARC, corporate relocation, U.S. to U.K. traffic, has increased to about 10% of its peak after dropping to almost zero 18 months ago, she said. It's just starting, Golden said, green shoots of recovery, as they say. Westbetcher isn't convinced the boom times will return. The ethos of the ambitious, high-earning American is, I will do anything to make money, even if it means moving my family, he said. When the performance bonuses go away, the value of being in this country goes away. So, kind of interesting, but predictable, very predictable. And the government response is also predictable. It's denial. You know, they're in denial. They don't want to admit that what they're doing is wrong. You know, that's just the typical government response. You know, and that's just what, again, I cannot understand why people can't see that and why they continue to think that government is somehow, you can tweak it somehow or somehow make it work, because you can't. It's a failure. It's always a failure. It always, big government always leads, without fail, it always leads to disaster. Every time. You can't make it work. It's unworkable. So, anyhow, better be wrapping this up. Hope everyone is having a great week. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.